Have you registered for the upcoming Live Summit in London yet? If not, what are you waiting for? Imagine spending 2 days in person sharing ideas with the very people you've heard on this podcast. The tactics, strategies, and actionable insights that you'll take away are incredible. One of our repeat guests and Pinnacle Society members, Rich Rosen, attended a previous Live Summit, and he told us that he added $100,000 in additional revenue within just 45 days of attending from one strategy that he took away. Now, keep in mind, it was a strategy he was already aware of, and he knew he should be doing it. He just wasn't doing it. Have you ever been there? Can you relate to that? What made the difference was getting a detailed playbook he could implement, plus hearing from multiple recruitment business owners who had already successfully implemented that same strategy. That's what tipped him over the edge into action. If this sounds like something you could benefit from, then visit recruitmentcoach.com/summit.
Some of the magic of RPO is when you become an internal extension of their team. We want to get to the point where we can improve some of their internal processes and really help them run more efficiently. We want to get to the point where we can speak just like an internal team member and spend time on site there. And so to get to that point, you have to invest a fair amount of time. For me, that typically meant at least half of a recruiter's time. We valued our 180 recruiter's time at a minimum of $30,000 a month. So we wanted to see at least $15,000 a month in revenue there.
Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and today we're joined by Greg Fisher.
During that period of time where I had opened up that gym, you know, I was starting my workday at 5, 6 a.m. I was finishing at 9, 10 p.m., often working weekends. And I had built up, talk about resilience, I'd built up an immense amount of resilience. And my belief and understanding of what I was capable of was just so much higher. And so I was able to take that extra capacity of just energy and put it into the business once I became an owner of that business. And I think that unlocked a lot just more passion and energy and action that helped push us forward as well.
Greg is the former co-owner of AMI Network, a healthcare recruitment agency that made $1.4 million in net profit on $4.2 million in revenue. That's a very healthy 33% profit.
We're probably producing, I don't know, 50 to 70% more hires than the internal recruiters at that company as well, because we set that system up to back them. And it was wildly profitable. We were probably running 30 to 40% profit margins on that.
What was the secret? Well, 18 of his 40 team members were offshore high-performing employees with annual retention of over 85%.
A lot of agencies I talk to aren't ready to hire offshore. And I think same thing, maybe they had that mindset initially. They're like, I'll just hire somebody. And I think the other two things that are really necessary is to actually have a training process. Whatever you want done, whether it's sourcing, whether it's admin work, whether it's sales, it's not an easy button. Just like with any onshore employees, actually having SOPs and a process and be able to say, don't just go source, this is what good sourcing looks like, for instance.
Now he runs a firm called Well-Oiled Machine that recruits offshore and nearshore staff for recruitment firms and staffing agencies.
We're essentially a direct hire agency for offshore employees today. We sit down with an agency owner and say, what function or functions within your business make sense to take offshore? We help them decide what country or countries to look in. We help them build out the compensation model, figure out things like, should you offer benefits? What should those look like?
Greg, welcome. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks, Mark.
Awesome. So you're joining us today from Colorado. I think it's 7 a.m. there. Just before we hit record, you were telling me about a bear getting into your garage or something. What happened?
Oh, yeah, that was a fun night. Well, first, my partner moved in and we spent all night bringing her clothes in. We're already pretty exhausted. And then around 2 a.m., the dogs start barking and barking and barking all night. They're going off all night. We wake up in the next morning, the garage door is torn open, trash is everywhere. And a bear gets
goodness. There. It ripped your garage door off.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
The bears out here are different.
Crazy. That definitely doesn't happen in Scotland. Our bears, there used to be bears in Britain, but they're all hunted to extinction, unfortunately. So, and their forests are all like the whole of the UK basically is, I mean, there are some woods, but it's mostly farm. It's all been cultivated over thousands of years. So, no bears, but, yeah, well, thank you for getting up early to do this, even though you had a rough night. So, Greg, this is the first time we're actually talking, but I feel like I already know you because we've been having conversations on LinkedIn for a few months now. And I'm really interested in what you're doing because what you offer is very much aligned with the strategies that we teach in our coaching program as well. But look, before we get into all that, tell me about how you got into recruiting.
Yeah, well, just like pretty much every other guest on here, totally by accident. I thought I was going to have a career in the fitness industry. I spent 7 years working for a big gym chain, 24-Hour Fitness, worked my way up into management. And then a month after I got married, I got fired. And over decision that made a judgment call, probably wasn't the right move, but the company decided that was it. And here I am, freshly married, trying to find work, have a mortgage to pay, didn't have a huge savings at the time. And I had always wanted to open my own gym. And so I thought, hey, this is the chance to do it. But as the bank account's getting lower and lower, I need something to do. I'm applying to jobs. And I end up getting recruited by a solo recruiter to work for him and really thought about this and said, hey, you know, as long as I can make six figures, pay the mortgage, I'll do this for a little bit. I'll get my gym open. But here we are 11 years later and I'm still doing this.
Right. That's funny. Yeah. A lot of people get into recruiting. They don't really see it as a long-term career. It's more of just like a kind of stopgap sort of thing. And to be fair, not everyone lasts this long, right? So there's a high burnout or turnover in the first couple of years. But if you make it past year two, you're pretty much a lifer. So tell me about AMI Network then. When did you start that business?
Yeah, so I wasn't the founder, eventually became an owner, but I was the first employee. So I was recruited by the solo founder. It was a healthcare search firm at the time, just doing permanent placements in Los Angeles. Nurses, nursing leadership, some other leadership as well. We thought we were niched. We really weren't that niched. We slowly started building up the business. And I think I'm very fortunate to have gotten I got an MBA working at 24-Hour Fitness, where they really showed me how to lead, how to manage, how to performance manage, how to use KPIs. And I think pretty quickly, the owner and myself started to be able to scale and add a few team members.
Wow, that's awesome. So over what time frame did you go from just the two of you to having 40 team members?
Yeah, so there was a big milestone. I think it took us about 7 years to get there. In hindsight, probably could have done it in half the time. But We actually got stuck about halfway through that. We grew to about $1 million in permanent placements pretty quickly. Had a couple of 180 recruiters, and the business was profitable, not profitable enough that we wanted to start to build out a sales team. And we're the typical owner's dilemma that I'm sure you see all the time, where we're trying to run everything, we're trying to do everything, we can bring in enough clients to keep the business going, but we weren't really developing accounts and we were just stuck at $1 million. And that's actually where we first heard of offshore. We went to a Mike Gianta workshop. He talked about doing offshore. We were like, wow, okay, this could be a way that we could remain profitable and start to scale. And so we started, we went with the BPO. I had a horrible experience, unfortunately, where we were said, hey, okay, we need you to help us find leads. And of course, what they brought back to us wasn't what we were looking for. And so then we tried another and another, and eventually probably took a year and a half or so to figure it out. But eventually we started to get things right, where we started really viewing our offshore team members like internal team members. Things really started clicking. And within 3 years of flatlining at $1 million for 4 years, we then hit that $4 million gross margin.
That's incredible growth in 3 years. When was this, Greg?
So this would have been, let's see, I think we probably around 2017, 2018 is where we started to really hit that big growth pivot. And I'd say there are maybe three or so things that I think really clicked all around the same time that allowed that to happen.
Well, obviously, I want to know what those three things are, but so hold that thought before we do that. I just wanted to comment that the it's such a common scenario to kind of get stuck at whatever level, whether it's a million or even less than that, because whether it's the founder or someone might have a very small team, and there's enough profit to pay everyone and for the owner to have a good lifestyle, but they feel like there's not enough profit to really start hiring more people. So you're kind of stuck at that level, right? So you're busy and you're kind of maxed out. You're doing so many, like you're doing everything yourself. And, but the business is more or less just paying you and paying for itself, but there's not a whole lot left over. And so I think what we're going to get to here in this conversation is that by hiring internationally, you can actually grow a lot faster than if you're just hiring locally, right? So it's cool that you stumbled upon that concept. And I'm so happy to hear that you stuck with it, even though it initially was a bad experience, because I think that's where a lot of our listeners probably a lot of people have tried it, right? Maybe they think they know what offshore hiring is, and but they haven't taken the time to really understand it and master it. And maybe they tried it, it didn't work out, and then they gave up on it prematurely. So, what are these three things then? Let's cover those. Three things allowed you to grow so quickly.
Yeah, well, why don't we start with where you left off with offshore? That was a big one. And I think for us, one of the things that really pains me is so many people see offshore as replacing jobs, and I don't see it that way. It wasn't that way for us. It was adding jobs that we couldn't otherwise add that allowed us to do things that we otherwise weren't doing. So we were running our sales strategy at the time was the play that pretty much everybody does today, but at the time it was novel, where we would go onto Indeed and LinkedIn, find what job openings were out there, we do a little research in the company, find the decision maker, drop them into a drip email campaign. Back in those days, you didn't even need to cold call often. You could just rely on email. But it would work really well. But the problem was volume. While I was running a lot of the business, my business partner was running a lot of the business, we just didn't have the time and energy to add a huge amount of volume. And so that was really the first use case for us, was we found somebody phenomenal offshore in the Philippines and really brought him into our team. He was joining all of our meetings, really understanding our business. We spent a lot of time training and coaching on what companies we were looking for, how to find them. And that started working really well. And all of a sudden, we started going from, you know, a sales appointment a month to a sales appointment a week. And we're like, wow, okay, this is not very expensive. We can keep doing this. And so that was one really big catalyst. And then, of course, we said, well, what about the rest of our business? And at the time, we had a $300,000 a year quota for our 180 recruiters. And we said, well, wait, what if, you know, the business development research, that's kind of like sourcing for candidates. So can we just repeat this there? And so, of course, we repeated this there. And then when the recruiters didn't have to do very much sourcing, we said, great, we think you can do $400,000. And they were able to actually increase their revenue as well. So the offshore piece was a huge, huge part. And eventually we started, when we got into the RPO model, which is second point, we were able to run the RPO model much more efficiently because we were able to have team members in Latin America speaking to candidates. We created an incredible pipeline there. On the sales side, we eventually started hiring appointment setters in Latin America also for our sales team. But it just enabled us to do things, Mark, that we never would have dreamed of doing because we just couldn't have afforded to invest the revenue in it.
Exactly, 100%. So picking up on your first point about hiring, so your first hire was someone helping you generate business development leads, right?
Yes, I should clarify, the first hire that worked out.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I understand. What I meant. Okay, so actually, before we dive into there, what didn't work that you tried before? Because I think let's start with what not to do.
Yeah. So I could write a book on it. First, we tried the BPO RPO model, which if you run an agency today, you probably get an email a day from one. And they had this promise, send us the leads you want, send us the candidates you want, and we'll come back with this at a very low cost. And which sounded amazing, but we found very quickly is that they just didn't understand our business and they didn't understand what a great lead looked like. And we tried to work with them and say, no, this is what we're looking for. But there's also a gap because they're doing the management, which initially was great. Hey, we'll bring the employees, we'll manage them. But if the employees weren't understanding, they weren't our employees. And so we really struggled to get the quality right. So after we tried two BPOs, we said, okay, let's hire somebody directly. But of course, as a small business, you're so worried about losing money. And so we said, well, okay, let's hire a freelancer. Because if this doesn't work, we can get rid of them really quickly. We can scale their hours up and down. And we were so, it was such a scarcity mindset. And of course, our first couple of freelancers were unreliable. And which at the time we were like, well, okay, this just doesn't work. In hindsight, if I were, it's interesting having conversations with a lot of people, especially in the Philippines now who do freelancing. And they're like, look, I don't know if I'm going to have a job tomorrow. I don't know if I'm going to, how many hours I'm going to have the next day. So I have to get three jobs and I can't really invest myself in any one job because it's probably going to go away. And so I didn't realize that was the world I was in. But of course, the first couple of freelancers didn't work out. Eventually, we found somebody who really happened to be on Upwork, but viewed it as a full-time job. These days, I never go to Upwork to hire, but we got lucky after probably like three hires on there and found somebody who was like, I want to have one job for life. And yeah, his name was Claude. And he, I think he's still with the company now, probably six years later.
Awesome. Yeah. I've had this similar experience in that what people think, they think a BPO type thing is, you know, is hiring offshore. But there's, we, like you, have decided that hiring someone directly and really integrating into your team as a fully fledged team member is much more successful and also much more satisfying, right? I think the challenge with the BPO is, number one, you mentioned is like the person's sort of removed from your team. They're not part of your team, right? They're on someone else's team. They're being managed by someone else. And yes, you're getting access to their like their work hours, but it just doesn't feel like they're fully integrated and part of your team. And then secondly to that is, obviously the BPO has to make a profit. And so chances are they're not paying like what you would pay if you were just hiring the person directly. And then they have quite a lot of turnover, right? Because the BPO industry tends to like churn through people. And so you get someone finally who is performing and who's doing well, they understand your company, you know, they're trained up, and then they leave, and then you're starting all over again with someone else. So so hiring direct is definitely the way to go, in my opinion. You then mentioned the other problem about freelance, that hiring direct is you encounter this issue. Well, the person, if you're hiring a freelancer, and this is sometimes our clients say, well, why don't I just hire, I want to test this. I'm just going to hire someone for a few hours a week and see how it goes. And be like, don't do that. Just look, it's not a big risk. If you think they're good, then bring them on full time. Because if you're only giving them a few hours, that means they have to have multiple other jobs or clients in order to pay their bills. So A, you're never going to have their full kind of energy and attention. And B, you could just lose them. If someone else wants to give them more hours, then you've lost someone who is really, really good. So just go all in and treat it like a full time, like you treat it and they both treat it. Both parties are treating this like a full-time job here. So anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah. And it's, you know, Mark, as you're saying this, it's so interesting because what you described is probably what the way I would say 80, 90% of agencies look at this. If we were talking about recruitment consultants, you go, Mark, that sounds crazy. Like, of course, I'm not going to go hire a freelance consultant on Upwork and expect to produce like a salaried employee. But yeah, I think the other piece, and it's something a lot of agencies I talk to aren't ready to hire offshore. And I think same thing, maybe they have that mindset initially. They're like, I'll just hire somebody. And I think the other two things that are really necessary is to actually have a training process. And whatever you want done, whether it's sourcing, whether it's admin work, whether it's sales, is it's not an easy button. Just like with your with any onshore employees, actually having SOPs and a process and be able to say, this is, don't just go source, this is what good sourcing looks like, for instance. And then to have some sort of management and coaching system where it's like, okay, this is what good looks like. Here's some numbers or some benchmarks to hit. I'm going to periodically come in and actually look at the work you're doing. I'm going to give you feedback on it. And then on a monthly basis, we're going to sit down and have a conversation about your performance and about your career trajectory and what you can do better and what's working well and what I can do better and what's working well. And just like we should with our onshore employees, but I think a lot of agencies don't take the time to map out those things beforehand and they just kind of wing it. But when you do, if you hire intentionally and then you train thoroughly and then you also manage systematically, yeah, then it's a recipe for success.
Absolutely. I love I'm not sure if it's something that I've read of yours on LinkedIn or a video. Maybe it was I think you did a LinkedIn video a few days ago where you were talking about how the way that you, not you, but the way that companies treat offshore employees, they've got it all wrong. And, you know, they need to consider them as equal to your onshore employees and not second class citizens. And it's completely the wrong mindset, because how is someone going to perform at their best or be fully productive if they're kind of just left over there and they're not a fully fledged member of your team, where they're getting access to the same, you know, systems, training, you know, coaching, career opportunities, and so on. And, you know, even though they're in another country from you, you still need to spend time with them, right? And make them feel part of the team. How did you come to this realization in your business?
Yeah, well, I think it came from a lot of reflection, because we wouldn't that way. And I would say we used a word that a lot of people use that pains me a bit, which is resources. And I mean, I think like somebody offshore is a person, just like somebody onshore, and really viewing them as people. But I think initially, and we could probably spend a while talking about colonialism and history and maybe where some of those perspectives come from. But for whatever reason, I think, yeah, initially we had that mindset too, and just kind of viewed offshore team members as resources. And I think a big part of it was probably myself working directly with people and getting to know somebody like Claude personally, and the way that he loves reading mystery novels. And, you know, we would both go nerd out on Excel together. And as we started to get to know each other and developed just like a true connection and friendship, I think that really shifted my perspective and just seeing our offshore team just like people like everybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but still, you've really cracked the code here, because I know quite a few recruiters have one or maybe two team members who are international, but you scaled, you had 18 out of a team of 40. So almost half of your team were offshore. So can you walk me through, like, what was the progression there? And when you finally had it running like well-oiled machine, to use your company name, what were the keys to making that really work?
Yeah. So I think once we cracked the code and Claude was really successful as far as bringing in new clients, then we also started to bring on some more team members, because we were looking at the cost, which I don't know, at the time it was maybe $1,000 a month. And we said, wow, if this individual is helping us get one new client a month for $1,000 a month, let's just keep doing this. And so we started hiring a couple of more people. We brought on some other team members to help us on the sourcing side, probably had a small team of 5 or 6, which at that point then we needed to have a supervisor. And so Valentina ended up getting promoted to supervisor. Then I think what started to happen for us is our business started to evolve. And maybe to take a bit of a detour into the second thing that really helped us grow is my business partner ended up having the sale of a lifetime. And he had gotten a call from a referral, and she said, hey, you know, we need help hiring an internal recruiter here. And so he started going down the normal path of what do you need, da 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 da. And he asked why now and why it was so important. And she said, well, we had a riff last year. Now things have shifted in the market. Now we're looking to grow. We need to build out a new team to update our EMR. We need to be prepared to take on a lot more patients. He's like, how many hires is this? She's like, we probably need about 50 hires over the next 6 months. And then he goes, have you heard of RPO before? And she goes, I've heard of it. Tell me more. And on the spot, he spun up an RPO service line for us.
Fantastic.
And he flipped it into a pitch for us being an embedded recruitment team and handling ourselves. And somehow we worked through this proposal process. We secured the deal, which was at the time a flat monthly retainer, pretty substantial. I think our first month was $50,000. And after that, it tapered down to about $30,000 a month. That client we ended up working with them for 3 years. Along the way, we ended up deciding, hey, this is pretty cool. And so we decided to then turn that off into its own division, which eventually became a $1.5 million division. And then on top of it, that client eventually came to us and said, hey, can you help us out with payroll? And so they started payrolling people, and very quickly we're like, oh, this is pretty sweet too. And so that then led to us spinning up a staffing division as well. And then along the way, that then led to the expansion of the offshore team, which we can dive into, but I feel like you probably want to dig into this a bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's any recurring revenue model is a beautiful thing, right? But a lot of search firms or permanent recruitment agencies think that if you do direct hire, like permanent placements, then it's just going to be lumpy revenue. Like you make 3 placements 1 month, 2 the next, 0 the next, 1 the next. And that it's impossible to have that recurring revenue. But the beauty of what you've just described is that you can create recurring revenue in a permanent placement business. And so I love this concept and the fact that your co-owner just kind of he heard a problem, he investigated that need, and then he presented a solution. So that's classic solution selling, right? But how did you develop that into a product that you were able to sell to others?
Yeah. So we threw this thing together. They had a very short timeline. They were way behind on this hiring project. And, you know, it involved us so many late nights. It was a very exciting time, but a very exhausting time. But eventually, after probably about a year or so, I think we figured out a good service where we're really adding an immense amount of value to their team. I mean, I think over the course of 2 years, they went from a 100-person company to a 250-person company. And we were really one of the driving forces behind that. But I think after about a year or so, we felt like we understood how to do this well enough where we could go take that conversation to others. And so we started looking to do that. And I was still doing sales at the time. And so I was just being very opportunistic. And I would ask some questions. You know, usually the call would open up about direct hire or contract staffing. But I would usually ask into some other questions as well. What are your plans for growth? What are your hiring goals overall? And do you have any plans for expansion? And so I would start to ask a few questions. And if I heard some of the right keywords, then I would start to look to present that. And we also started to look at our existing accounts. And we did have an account. I wrote a post about this the other day. We had an account that on paper was horrible. There were a 17% contingent client that 5 other agencies worked with. We actually did relatively well with them. It was probably a $100,000 to $300,000 a year account regardless. But at some point, we started to get to know their team really well. And they started to talk about some big hiring. We started to ask, what are your plans for next year? They started to share a lot of big hiring needs. And so we presented it to them. That probably took a year and a half to close, but that became an $80,000 a month account as well. That also lasted for several years. So yeah, really a combination of internal expansion and opportunistic expansion with other sales.
What's awesome is I think your point about hiring internationally combined with the RPO model is like a match made in heaven because, right, then as you, because here's what scares a lot of small recruiting firms away from trying to win those big projects is they're like, there's no way I can deliver to that, right? And so they don't even pitch for what could be a million or, you know, multi six figure opportunity per year because they couldn't physically themselves deliver. But you could scale up your team to serve that account by leveraging those offshore team members, right?
Yeah. And that's the nice thing is these jobs are in demand, and often some of the starting points for offshore require less specialized experience, less training. So it is very easy to scale. You can also hire very high level folks offshore, and we can talk about that too. But when I look at that $80,000 a month account, what that looked like was we did have at times 3 to 4 consultants in the US doing a lot of the front end delivery, conversations with hiring managers. One of them was a manager. However, then we had a huge offshore team backing them. We had 4 team members who were doing all the sourcing. And then we had a team member doing all the screening for the more entry level roles. So it was just this team constantly sources and they were producing just a wealth of candidates. We had David doing the screening and then he would push through the candidates to the recruiters. And so those recruiters were probably producing, 50 to 70% more hires than the internal recruiters at that company as well, because we set that system up to back them. And it was wildly profitable. We were probably running 30 to 40% profit margins on that.
Yeah, I love it. When you're evaluating an RPO opportunity, how much volume do you need to make this, for it to make sense? Like what, in terms of the client, how many hires would they need to make in order to, for you to decide to pitch this model?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think some of the magic is RPO is when you become an internal extension of their team. And if you're still an external recruiter, yes, you can make some placements, but there's not the same level of efficiency and impact on the organization. Like we want to get to the point where we can improve some of their internal processes and really help them run more efficiently. We want to get to the point where we can speak just like an internal team member and spend time on site there. And so to get to that point, you have to invest a fair amount of time. For me, that typically meant at least half of a recruiter's time. If it was going to be a lot less than that, we're not going to be able to invest that energy. And it's really just a direct hire client at that point. So for us, we valued our 180 recruiter's time at a minimum of $30,000 a month. So we wanted to see at least $15,000 a month in revenue there. The volume could vary a bit depending on what type of search we're talking about. But for us, typically it meant having at least 5 to 10 requisitions in a given month that we could work on.
Got it. Okay. So 5 to 10 jobs per month. And yeah. Okay. Fantastic. And then with your model, did you have did you charge placement fees on top of the monthly retainer? How did the math work?
Yeah. So we initially were doing flat monthly retainers that we were just like, wow, this is amazing. Eventually we realized that model actually wasn't effective in most scenarios. Because on one end, we had an issue where our clients started having all these more demanding searches. They started wanting us to hire mid-level leadership. And in hindsight, we said, oh, we should have written in a permanent placement fee for more senior level roles that take more time. We didn't, but we started to recognize very quickly, whoa, we need to charge them more, but we didn't necessarily put any sort of tiers into the project. Then fast forward a year, the volume drops. Now they're upset because they're overpaying for the search volume. And so you can do a flat fee model with tiers that goes up and down. I find that's really hard to adapt. What we ended up eventually moving to was an open fee, closed fee model. So for each unique search that we did, we would charge, typically you would see a placement fee between 5 and 10% of the total compensation. Half of that 5 to 10% would come as an open fee. So 2 to 5%, 2.5 to 5%. half of that would come to a placement fee once the search closed.
I don't really understand that. Could you dumb it down for me?
Yeah. So, so let's say that you have 10 searches. They're all unique. They're different types of roles. They pay $100,000 a year apiece. For each of those searches, maybe the total fee would be $5,000. We would charge half of that fee, so $2,500, when we start the search. So, and if you want to say come and add an 11th one of those, we would say great, another $2,500 for us to begin that. And then once we make the placement, then we would charge another $2,500.
Okay. And is that in addition to the monthly fee or is it included?
We eliminated the monthly fee at that point.
Oh, I see. Okay, gotcha.
But you essentially had one because clients would always be adding more searches. So inevitably, there'd be some variability, but you would typically be getting retainers every month.
Okay. All right. Awesome. That's interesting. Because I've seen different ways of doing, of pricing this model. One being to say, well, this is the monthly fee and that gets you like one full-time recruiter working on your jobs, right? That's one way I've seen it. And so depending on the volume of jobs, you need X number of recruiters. So this would be the cost. And so you're then making the difference between what you're charging the client and then what you're paying to your offshore recruiters. And I've also seen it that you're still charging a placement fee and the monthly subscription is really like the deposit against the final invoice. So for example, if you charge $10,000 a month, and then, but you make $40,000 worth of placements in a quarter, then they've already paid $30,000. So you just invoice for the difference, which is the extra $10,000. And if you do $25,000 in placements, then they've got basically a credit of $5,000 against the following month, that type of thing. So I've seen so many different ways of doing this, but bottom line is, it's a beautiful model because you get that forecastable revenue, right? You said something earlier about helping your U.S. recruiters to bill more. Can you elaborate on that? Because I think that's an overlooked benefit of having offshore sourcers and lead generators.
Yeah, absolutely. So we, you know, recruiters, a 180 recruiter is probably spending 30 to 50% of their time sourcing candidates. And even then, depending on the search, they're often not getting access to all the candidates. So we recognize that sourcing could be systematized pretty well. And that as long as you could create a solid process for it, that could easily be delegated to an offshore team member. So within our businesses, we created a 2-to-1 support model where you would have one offshore sourcer per two recruiters. And we developed a process for the recruiters. Hey, when you have a new search, here's how you hand it off. We had our recruiters, we were Boolean nerds. We really believed that optimizing Boolean was a big part of it. And so our recruiters would outline, here are the three qualities we're looking for on a resume. Here is the Boolean string to try or Boolean strings. And then they would hand that off. And typically there would be some sort of calibration where they would take the time to go through, this is a good resume, this isn't a good resume. But that would be it. The recruiter would just have to essentially assign the search, which would take 15 minutes. The sourcers would go do that. There'd be a little bit of feedback, but the sourcing was done for them in the majority of cases. And that did two things. One, it now freed up that 30 to 50% of the recruiter's time and reduce that to maybe 10% of their time. The second thing it did is allowed us to do far more sourcing. Because now we had 20 hours a week of that sourcer just dedicated to sourcing for that recruiter. They could get more candidates. It also allowed us to do things that we otherwise weren't doing. Like we started thinking of all these crazy projects where we're like, okay, let's go into the state database of nurses where you go to verify a license. And instead of typing in a name, just hit enter. We'll get 20,000 nurses. And we're going to just systematically, when maybe the search volume is low, we're going to go through and find the contact info for these 20,000 nurses. And so it started leading to, like, we were adding 100,000 to 150,000 contacts a year to our ATS by doing that.
Brilliant. Absolutely. Like if in a normal day-to-day of a recruiter, you're never going to have time to do that, right? But, and yet that's building an extremely valuable asset. What do you think, apart from what we've already described, what do you think recruitment businesses get wrong when it comes to trying to work with international talent?
Yeah, so I think it's a few things. Some we've already covered, but they're worth going back to. I think the biggest is viewing them as resources or second-class team members and not investing them. And it's really just about however you view your internal team, view your offshore team that way. And it should lead, people ask me a lot about retention, and your retention of your offshore team members should be very close to your retention of onshore. That's a big one. And then I think the implications of that are then leading to being highly intentional about how you hire and going through a very rigorous screening process. And then also being deeply invested in training and management.
Absolutely. Yeah, agree 100% with all of those. By the way, I'm looking down my notes here and saying that you had three keys to scaling your previous business. And I think we've covered one and two, but what was the third one?
Yeah, so the third one was really me being fully invested. And so, and actually the story becoming an owner. So I had still held on to this passion of wanting to open up my own gym. And so while our business was doing about $1 million in revenue, direct hire revenue, and we were coasting around there trying to figure things out, I had gotten together two partners to go open up a small gym in Santa Monica. And I go approach the owner of our agency and say, hey, this has always been a passion of mine. I want to do this. I have two partners who are going to be there during the day to day. I'm going to be the investor and the operations guy. I'm still going to continue to be the managing partner of this agency, you know, from 9 to 5, but early mornings, late at night, I'm going to be working on building up this gym. And, you know, if at any point, like working for AMI Network is still my top priority. If this falters, we need to talk about it. This comes first. This is what's paying my mortgage. But this is my plan. And I'll give them a lot of credit because I think a lot that would have scared the heck out of a lot of owners at that point. He had put a lot of trust in me. He had seen me at least help to build this agency to $1 million. And so he said, okay. And for the next year, I started trying to build out this gym. And it was a complete and utter failure, and a lot of lessons learned along the way. But a year later, we ended up selling the rights to the lease. We got very lucky, and it was a very desirable building, and we ended up getting out without too much pain. And at that point, I go back to Daniel, the owner of AMI Network, and I said, okay, here's where I'm at. I want to be in a point where I have financial freedom relatively early in life, around the time where I'm 40. And I don't see that happening through just earning a salary here and you know, my overrides and all that. It's going to come through ownership in a business. And there's two ways I see this unfolding. One is we continue this relationship as it is. I'll at some point start up some other business that I'm really excited about. Once that business succeeds, we'll shake hands. I'll walk away, and that'll be my life. Or two, I see a future here, but right now the opportunity isn't great enough. You really want freedom and the opportunity to step out. If you can give me a large enough ownership stake in this business, I will fully dedicate myself to here. You've seen what a fractional Greg will do, where a lot of my energy is elsewhere. Imagine if I'm fully dedicated. And he said, you know what? I like that deal. We ended up working out a deal for about a third of the company in phantom equity. And then I was fully dedicated. And really, during that period of time where I had opened up that gym, you know, I was starting my workday at 5, 6 a.m. I was finishing at 9, 10 p.m., often working weekends. And I had built up, talk about resilience, I'd built up an immense amount of resilience. And my belief and understanding of what I was capable of was just so much higher. And so I was able to take that extra capacity of just energy and put it into the business once I became an owner of that business. And I think that unlocked a lot just more passion and energy and action that helped push us forward as well.
Amazing. Yeah, I can relate to that. That's really cool. Greg, so at what point, now, and it sounds like you guys were absolutely smashing it. So what led you to ultimately leave that business and start your current business, Well-Oiled Machine?
Yeah. And so after 10 years in the business, I'd gone through a lot of life changes, leaving Los Angeles for Colorado. Really, my life flipped upside down in a lot of ways. And during that period, I'd really been reflecting a lot of areas of my life, and work started to be one of those. And I started to realize that my former boss, now my business partner, had very different values than I did. And a lot of it came down to the way that we saw people, and even some of the way we saw offshore employees, but also onshore. And it just didn't work for me. And I recognized that we could continue working together, but one of us would have to compromise our values and our vision. And it wasn't going to be me. And so I made the decision to leave. And initially, I thought I was really burnt out. I thought I would just go start a small agency up. That was enough to get by on, work part-time, spend a lot of time out in the mountains. And as I started doing that, the fire just wasn't there, and it felt like a drag every morning. But what did happen is I started having some peers in the meantime who came to me and said, "Hey, Greg, my business is so-so. I've been thinking of ways to grow it. I tried offshore, but it didn't work out. But like you built a business around offshore. Can you maybe give me some help here?" And I started asking some questions, and it was all the things that we talked about before. And I saw this really big opportunity for a lot of recruitment firms to do things the right way with offshore as a way to scale their business and also help out their teams. And so I spent the first 6 months really viewing this as a consultant, where it'd be like, "Mark, let's talk about your business. I'll help you figure out where offshore makes sense and help you build that out." Over the course of around 6 months, I realized two things. One, I wasn't as passionate about consulting. And then two, I realized that while some people valued that, what they really wanted more is a part of offshore done for you, and which is specifically the hiring part and finding great people. And so that then led to the launch of Well-Oiled Machine, which we're essentially a direct hire agency for offshore employees today, with an added wrinkle where we actually start in the initial planning stage of the process, where we sit down with an agency owner and say, what function or functions within your business make sense to take offshore? And once we get really clear on that, we help them decide what country or countries to look in. We help them build out the compensation model, figure out things like, should you offer benefits? What should those look like? And so we go through down that path together. One of the things that's really cool is at that point, I now have a perfect job. If you look at your job chart, I now have an A job, because we've gone through and designed a role that's really attractive and very realistic to fill. Then we go out and fill that role. We go out and identify the talent. Because a lot of agencies are unfamiliar with offshore, we actually join some interviews, help them understand cultural differences if that exists. Once they make the hire, we guarantee them for 12 months, and that's it.
Amazing. Okay, cool. So I'd love to pick your brains on this, because I noticed that you do, so on your website, it looks like your main markets are Philippines and LATAM. And I'm wondering, this question of which country should I find someone in is almost overwhelming, because there's talented people everywhere, right? It could be Eastern Europe, could be India, could be, LATAM countries, could be Philippines or what have you. How do you make that decision, like where they are going to find the best talent for their position?
Oh, it's so much fun. And there's a few layers to this. The first one I like to start with is function, and really first understanding what are you looking to have this individual to do today? And also, how could you see this role evolving? One of the biggest decisions with that is, are they going to be getting on video on the phone externally with a candidate or client? If the answer is yes, my next question is who are you going to be having them get involved with, and where are they going to be based? And so if we're going to be working with higher level decision makers or candidates in the United States, you're typically going to find, so let's say a half desk recruiter, a sales development representative, maybe even an account manager. You're typically going to have the most success in Latin America. And if I'm going to throw a dart at the map, it's going to be Mexico, where you have the highest concentration of overlap with US culture. So that's often, that's one decision tree. Now, if you said, hey, Greg, it's actually going to be, we're a UK-based search firm, and they're going to be speaking to candidates in Europe, I would look somewhere like South Africa, where there's a lot more overlap with European culture than somewhere like Latin America. Or if you said it's going to be a non-speaking role, or the conversations are going to be much simpler, like maybe it's more transactional, like they're just calling 100 call center reps a day, or maybe they're calling to say, what's the name of your human resources director, and that's it, then somewhere like India, Pakistan, the Philippines can all be really effective. A lot more layers to that, but that's the simplest way, I think, to look at that.
Okay, got it. And so this is a one that most owners don't believe you can offshore, is someone who's talking to clients and sort of senior level candidates. And so I think it's easier for them to get their head around, okay, like definitely someone who's going to be working with data, sourcing leads, sourcing candidates, maintaining the database, you know, building prospect lists, all that kind of stuff. No brainer. Let's find someone offshore to do that. And then maybe there's another layer, which is like an EA, someone managing calendar, someone who does have client contacts, but it's mainly through email, and someone who maybe is involved in your social media planning and all that kind of stuff. And so people can get their head around that. But Over and over, I hear people say, Mark, there's no way that our clients would respond to somebody calling them from another country, right? They just wouldn't give them the time of day. What's your take on that?
Yeah, well, I think first, it's always worth reflecting on that. And I think we believe we're a lot more special than we are in the UK, in the United States, and we're not. All of these other countries have billion-dollar companies with highly, highly, highly competent, much more competent people than I am. And are they on Upwork? No. Are they working for BPO? No. You usually have to go out and headhunt them, but they exist. So like perfect example, one of the things I love about Mexico, all of the Shreks have offices in Mexico to recruit for Mexico corporations. Some of these individuals aren't going to speak great English. Most of them have master's degrees, speak phenomenal English. And just for context, the other day, I was speaking to a candidate. He worked for one of the Shreks. He worked for Hydrix. He was telling me about a conversation he was having with the CEO of a bank the other day in Mexico. Somebody like that, by the way, he's earning a $2,000 a month base salary right now. And yeah, I would trust him with my life to put him on the phone with a senior executive in the United States.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. I think you're right. It's more of a mind block than a reality, right? Because as you say, there's sophisticated, you know, highly educated, competent people in every country. It's just that maybe you're looking in the wrong place, or you're not going about this search in the right way. I had a client who was he was Irish. He worked for a search firm in the US for many years, and then he moved to Spain. And he was running a global executive search firm from Barcelona, but recruiting mainly in the United States, but also worldwide for large global companies. And his entire team he had one guy who was British, the rest of the team were Spanish. So their first language was Spanish, English was a second language, but they were extreme and just really ambitious, highly educated, very business savvy young men and women who had no problem getting on the phone with clients, with candidates, with like C and VP level people.
Yeah.
And clients had zero problem with that because they carried themselves. They had executive presence, right? They had confidence. They could carry themselves, you know, at an appropriate posture to have those conversations. It just so happened they had a Spanish accent, but perfect English, right? So I think it can definitely work.
Yeah,
sorry, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was going to say also, it's not unusual to find candidates, especially, I know we keep going back to Mexico. It's not the only place that I look, but Mexico also has a huge concentration of expats. So if you are in a space where even a little bit of a Hispanic accent might put that employee at a disadvantage, last week, we probably spoke to 4 people who were born and raised in the U.S. and live in Mexico now.
Good point. Absolutely. And having said that, though, the accent issue, I think, is overstated because there's lots of people who live in the UK or in the US who have become citizens, but they still have an accent, right? So you can't necessarily even tell where someone is calling you from just based on their accent. What are some of the other? Oh, geez, we're running out of time. This is like, I'm just getting going here. Look, there's something I'm dying to ask you because it's how you got on my radar, Greg, which is you are very good at strategic commenting on LinkedIn. Could you tell me a little bit about how you use that as a business development strategy? Because I think that is something that I want to do more of, and I'd love to learn how you do it.
Yeah, absolutely. So first, I'll preface with saying that we built AMI Network 100% on cold outbound. We were very bad about getting referrals. We generated 0 inbound. We were really good at cold outbound. When I decided to build this business, I didn't want to do it that way. I recognized that there's just a different path to do that. And so I dedicated myself, Mark, not that long ago, it was back in March, to building through LinkedIn. So of course, I started posting daily and nobody took notice. But what I did recognize is that my target audience was recruitment firms and staffing agencies, and that there were a lot of other people that they were following. And I needed to get on their radar. So spent about a month putting together a list of everybody who had a very strong reputation in that world and was also active on LinkedIn. And it was a study to get there. And so then what I realized is that if I could go engage with those individuals and do it in a way that's authentic, that's interesting, that's supportive of them and what they're doing, that they would take notice and other people who were engaging with their content would take notice. And that became a daily practice where I had my lists and you can build a custom feed on, if you don't know how to do that, I'm happy to send it to you. But I built a custom feed with 60 different thought leaders in the space. Every single morning, I would go on, look at their posts. If something spoke to me, jump in, make a comment. And that just became a routine. And yeah, it's pretty wild to see how quickly that then led to my post starting to get a lot of traction as well.
Yeah, it's super smart. And what I've noticed recently, LinkedIn has now started showing you how many views you've had on your comment, right? So it is a way of getting, it is a type of content in and of itself where you're piggybacking off of somebody else's network. Do you mind sharing like how many people are on your list at any one time, like kind of influencers or whatever? And then how long per day do you, like, what does that daily habit look like? How time consuming is it?
Yeah, so I have about 60 folks on my list. You have to break them into chunks of 20. So my routine is typically about an hour a day. So I try to hop on about 30 minutes before I post, start going through it, put my post out there, and then I spend another 30 minutes doing it after. And to your point, there are days where the most impressions I get are from a comment. And I've had 10,000, 20,000 impression comments before as well.
Super interesting. Wow. Greg, let's continue this conversation offline because I'd like to get to know you better, and I'm sure there's a lot we could learn from each other. But if people want to get to know you and find out more about what you do, what's the best place for them to start?
Certainly have my website, welloiledmachine.co. LinkedIn is typically the place. I'm on there daily talking about recruitment, talking about offshore, occasionally posting about the mountains.
Fantastic. All right. Well, we'll include links to both of those in the show notes. But Greg, this was fun. Thank you for thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, this is a blast.
All right, awesome. Have a great day. Thank you for listening to The Resilient Recruiter. I know how busy recruiters are, so I'm honored that you're investing this time with me each week. I don't take your attention for granted. That's why I'm going all out to deliver value for you here, real insights you can apply to improve your business. And if you really want to help me to reach a wider audience and impact more people, please consider leaving the show a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you leave me a review, please reach out and let me know so I can thank you personally. Please hit the subscribe button and I'll see you next time.